It's like old home week here, so you all have heard me way too much. I should just say, yeah, that again. So, I have to say, I get a little thrill out of the first, like, real snow of the season. It's almost time to put on the Christmas tunes and the whole thing. You try not to. And it's always better when the first real snow of the season comes in November instead of October, right? So, anyway, so we'll take it. So I want to spend some time, hopefully have time for questions, and actually anytime during the presentations you have questions, you want to throw things at me, that's fine. I'm pretty good at dodging stuff. But I want to talk a little bit about this idea of saving libraries. And I want to, so where did this, don't save libraries, save the world instead, where did that come from? So on Monday, I think it was Monday, I spoke at the Digital Library Forum 2013 thing in Austin. I was actually not in Austin, which was fun, but I got to speak on it. And during the presentation where I was talking a lot about what digital libraries need to be and all these kind of stuff, I made the statement, libraries don't need saving. And I've said this before. I wrote a blog post on it, all this wonderful stuff, which I'm sure you've read. And, you know, the idea was we keep talking about saving libraries, saving libraries, saving libraries. We need to stop worrying about saving libraries and start worrying about being important. That's how you save them, not talking about it. That was the opening keynote. The next afternoon, Char Booth, who did an amazing job, did the closing keynote, and she opened her closing keynote by saying, Dave's wrong. Libraries need saving and always have. And if you have a chance, the whole thing's online and you can watch it. She does a really good job, because what Char Booth talks a lot about is the notion of a critical voice and privilege and sort of social class and status and all these rather deep ideas. And her point being that libraries of all sorts do things that don't always, when you look at them, make people comfortable, right? You know, there's like business interests that aren't thrilled with sort of the openness of information idea. There are some parent groups that aren't necessarily that thrilled about the openness of information and reading and freedom to read and intellectual freedom and all these kinds of things. And so throughout history, libraries have had to fight for their existence. That it can't be as a given that libraries exist. We, you know, she shows pictures of like World War II bombing of libraries, and of course Library of Alexander burning. You know, it depends on whether you're anti-Semitic or whether you're anti-Muslim or anti-Christian who did it. But the point is that she says, you know, these are critical institutions. These are institutions that often seek to preserve rather underserved populations, and so therefore they're always a bit in danger. We have to strive to fight them. But when you break down the arguments and you really look at what we're saying, we don't obviously radically disagree about these things, right? So what I want to spend a little bit of time on is talking about this idea of not saving libraries in the world. And I'm going to make the following premise, that the durability of an organization, its lasting power, its legacy, its all of this, that the durability of an organization is determined by the impact that members of that organization have on others. Right? Now, the reason I bring this is the other criticism. This whole thing is a response to Char Booth. Thanks for showing up as I have that conversation. The other criticism that I received was that I put too much faith in the individual, that the librarians have to change things, that there's institutional power, there's organizational power. If anyone may remember, several years ago, the Danbury Library got together and made this statement on libraries, and this is what libraries are. And it was sort of like libraries are this eternal thing of which librarians sort of float in and out of. That the durability of the institution lasts beyond the individual. And this is sort of institutional thinking, right? That if you're working at Bird Library existed before you. Bird Library may exist after you. We'll have that discussion. You know, if you're working in a public library, et cetera. And so therefore, there's power in this institution. And so by claiming that everything's an individual act, you sort of miss this idea of power. When you show up and say, I'm from the Library of Congress, or I'm from, you know, Oxford's Academic Library, there's a cachet that comes with it that you didn't necessarily create. Fine, I'll give you that. But on the other hand, if the members of that organization don't maintain the brand, don't maintain the reputation, don't act in a way that's beneficial to their communities, that brand is going to disappear, right? I give you the example that right now, Apple is, you know, the cool, hep people, right? And Apple's having a problem because Samsung is becoming the cool, hep people in the technology industry. It's like, oh, you got an iPhone. Who doesn't, right? No, I've got a Galaxy Tab. I've got a phone that's this big. You know, I need to have a wagon that pulls my phone behind me. That's really cool. And I'll remind you of another technology organization you may have heard of called Sony. And Sony used to be the place, right? And now it's like, that's where I go buy crappy headphones, right? And so this idea is that the brand, the organization, the institution, without caretaking of the individual and the contributions of the individual, doesn't have a life of its own. It's something that we have to maintain and caretake. So what I want to talk a little bit about is that durability, that impact, comes from the services that we provide to the community, right? And so one of the speeches that I sort of give on a regular basis, and once again, I have students here that have to hear this way too much, is the idea that librarians are out there serving their communities, and that's where their value comes, right? It's not because they're there, and it's not because they're libraries. It's because people are doing something and having benefits. So I could give you that speech, and I'm going to give you that speech in one slide, because I'd rather spend time on this thing that I've been thinking about more recently, which is we also provide a model to other professional services. That while we serve doctors, while we serve professors, while we serve lawyers, we can also provide a model of what medicine and law and higher education can be. That in essence, we can show that as the world is changing, we have a pretty interesting idea of how these organizations can change with it. So that's what I want to spend some time on. So here's the one slide about where that came from and why we care about it, right? So this is what I consider the mission of librarians. The mission of librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in their communities. A couple things I'm going to point out, and then we'll leave it. First, I'm talking about the mission of librarians. A lot of discussion is, what is the mission of the library? What is the mission of the library? What is the mission of the library? And there is something to said for what the mission of the library is. And I think it's different than what the mission of the individuals working within it. For example, you may work in an academic environment where clearly your mission is to serve the students and faculty and staff of that institution. Fine. But you still have a larger individual mission that transcends that organization. That means that when the organization actually goes against it, you may have to take a principled stand that says you made the wrong decision. We have to challenge it. So it's a mission of individuals. I'm so tired of web pages and press releases and notifications about what the library did. Because the library can't do crap but be an org chart decay and fall into the ground, right? The library is presenting. No, the librarians are presenting. The librarians put together an exhibit. The librarians are teaching. The librarians are doing this. We need to be a little bit more out in front and not let our buildings necessarily speak for us. We need to be active in showing that we provide human value. We'll come back to that in a moment. That we are in the knowledge creation business. And that I get a lot of pushback on what that means. But the idea that, you know, I said this once, we're in the knowledge creation business. Our job is that students and teachers and professors and lawyers and doctors and whatever do their job better, create knowledge. And librarians going, excuse me, that's not my job. My job is to provide information. Their job is to worry about it. So I had an academic librarian say, my job is to give the information to the faculty member. Their job is knowledge creation with their students. I think that that's really sort of a bit of an outdated view. We see it in lots of different ways. We see, for example, when we now go to do accreditation of universities, the question isn't how many volumes you have and how many teachers you have. It's did the students learn something and how can you prove it? And that means that if the library is there and providing service and taking tuition dollars and saying that they're part of the accreditation process, they better demonstrate that they had an impact on student learning. We can no longer say we're one step removed from a learning process, that we are Piaget's kindergarten, that we are the area where we provide this rich area and people sort of wander through it and learn stuff and walk away. We have to see that that's an active gardening, tending process that we have to do. So we're in the knowledge creation business, that we create new knowledge. We create the discovery of the individual of knowledge that may have been longstanding, but to them, that's new knowledge. That we do it through facilitation. We do it by providing access to materials, access to resources, access to databases, and access to other people and individuals and expertise. Yes, but when you have access, it's not enough. If you show up and you have this wonderful access to this wonderful database and it's all in Greek and you don't speak Greek, access is irrelevant. Right? we have to also talk then about providing the basic training or knowledge of how to access it, right? Information literacy. Information literacy isn't you have an address book with getting to the library. It's what happens when you get there. How do you search? What do you search? How do you make sense of it? How do you synthesize it together? How do you evaluate the efficiency and effectiveness of it? And once they're there, we have to provide an environment that they feel safe doing. Right? One of the issues we have now is that Google has gone from do no evil to if I use Google, the NSA will know where my dental appointment is next week. Right? Google has moved from this idea of, oh, they're the cool hip startup to they're sort of the evil empire that we always pretended Microsoft was. Right. That this is the idea that they've provided an environment that we no longer necessarily feel completely safe within. And libraries, for a long time, have been talking, and I should be really careful, librarians have for a long time realized that they must create an environment that people feel safe within. Safe physically, but safe intellectually. You can check out this book, you can get this information, you can do whatever, and we're not going to sit there and go, oh, what were you reading yesterday? You've got to be kidding me, right? This is why I can like never do online reference, because when I do, the second response back from the librarian is, hi, Dave. You know, it's like, well, I guess I won't ask that herpes question. All right, moving on, right? How do we provide a safe environment, intellectually safe, physically safe, so that we can get to the information, we know what to do when we're in the conversation, in the information, and we feel safe in engaging it? And lastly, by motivating people. That can be everything from giving them badges to giving them degrees to giving them certification to giving them a pat on the back to obligating them to use it. One of the things that blows my mind is that we spend so much time talking about tenure in the academic world and how important it is and how we have to judge impact, and it's all through bibliographic data. Why don't we force librarians to be part of the review process? You know, why do we trust people like me to say, I have a self-interest in keeping myself employed. Here are my numbers, right? Absolutely, you know, and I'm counting everything. I'm counting the last time someone blogged, I was an idiot. That's a citation, right? Could we use extrinsic motivation? In other words, the institution obligating a good review, a good look, et cetera. So that's how we facilitate it. But ultimately, the reason we do all of this is to improve society, that our job is to make the world a better place. That we are, as a profession, as a vocation, have looked at information, knowledge, access, motivation, knowledge. We've looked at this as a way to push society forward, to improve it, to help it realize its goals and aspirations. And so we have to keep that larger, noble thing in mind. Now, that was my one speech about libraries. I put this up a while ago. And in fact, the first time I used this in public was at the Charleston conference, which is going on right now. And the first question I got was, I'm a publisher, why isn't that my mission? I'm a teacher, that's my mission. I'm a government agency, that's my mission. Why is this a mission of librarians other than the word you started with, librarians, in the first sentence? You could throw teacher, publisher. Why isn't this the mission of anyone seeking to improve society through knowledge creation? Why is this Google's mission? Now, the answer, the short answer is the means of facilitation, the values we bring to it, the skills we bring to it, and approach. But I want to flip that on its other side. A lot of librarianship expends a lot of effort trying to define ourselves by not being someone else. Right? Oh, we're a public library. What's the difference between you and a community center? Oh, we're not a community center because we have better parking, whatever it is, right? You know, why aren't you a help desk, right? Reference in the good old days of virtual reference, people remember, right? The idea is, well, you know, they're help desks and there are people asking questions. Why are you different than the person when I call Sears and say my refrigerator's broken? Oh, well, we have a master's degree, we can search faster and all this other stuff. But I want to flip that for a moment and say, what if we accept the premise that actually these are lots of companions in our quest to inform and improve the world? How can we utilize that? So my argument is that that is a mission of professional service, which means I need to define what professional services are. First, it's a profession in which service is important. Once again, duh, right? It's like, we paid you for this? Well, you didn't, but that's okay. What I define service as is when you go to assess your effectiveness, when you go to determine how good you are, how useful you are, the determined isn't your work, isn't your outcomes, it's the outcomes of someone else. of those you serve. In other words, to be an effective teacher, your students need to learn. To be an effective doctor, your patients need to live. We like that. Right? To be an effective librarian, your patrons, or as I will call them, members, need to have discovered or found their information. Right? Satisfaction, all these wonderful things. So service, we're looking at professions of which they are judged not by their own actions, but by the actions of those that they serve. Right? The second thing is that the provider is an essential part of that service. The expertise matters. So I have rubbish removal service. Every Wednesday, we drag the recycling and we drag the trash down to the curb. I can't tell you who my trash guy is. I can't tell you how he was qualified. I can't tell you how well he loads trash in the machine. It's just the trash disappears and I'm happy. I'm not putting those people in the middle of this. I go to an oncologist. I want to know where he got his degree. I want to know where he spends his lunch. I want to know what he read last week. I want to know everything about this individual. That person, that expert, matters in the service. And I would argue librarians are that way, or should be that way. A lot of the discussion about the future of libraries is through automation and taking people out of it and putting paraprofessionals on the desk and all of this other stuff really comes down to, do we value the individual delivering the service? Do they provide credibility? Do they provide efficiency? Do they provide effectiveness? How is it that that individual matters? Right? And that increasingly, while the professional services may not have knowledge creation as its primary goal, it is an increasing outcome of what they do. So I want to talk about two of these. I want to talk about medicine and I want to talk about higher education. Because medicine is changing dramatically. Medicine, it used to be you're sick, you go to the doctor, you sit in a chair, he or she looks at you as a bunch of problems, prescribes, fix the problem, throws you out of the office. Oh, you have diabetes. Here's a pill. Oh, you're fat. Here's a treadmill. I know that personally, right? But the idea is that that's sort of the relationship. It's very one-sided, etc. There's lots of studies that show that through patient-centered care, the more that doctor, the more the nurses, the more the whole medical system can do to educate you about your care, your disease, your health, the better the outcomes. And we already know that we changed this relationship to a doctor dramatically, right? When I go to the doctor, I have like 50 Medline articles sitting with me. So when he says, we're going to do this, I go, well, what about this one? And what about this one? And what about this one? And oh, he loves that, right? I was having lunch with Mike Eisenberg, and he was talking about, he was in the doctor's office, and they were talking about his wife's care. And the doctor turned and brought up Google and began to search. And Mike's like, I can do that better than you can. Stop it, right? There's a different relationship going on. And in higher education, I want to talk specifically about education, the delivery of it. So let's start with higher education. Let me talk about, once again, what these industries, what professional services can learn from us. So take as a given that you're providing excellent service to professors and doctors and all that. And that we tell them how you do it and such. Now let's talk about those industries and how they can benefit from us. So we know in higher education we got some problems. Scholarly publishing is a problem. Scholarly publishing is a problem for a couple of reasons. One, it's expensive and getting more expensive, right? It's the classic, the professors give it away and we have to buy it back, and that process is dysfunctional, we can't afford it, it's getting worse and worse and worse. But even on top of that, scholarly publishing is a mess because we don't even know as scholars how to do this and what we're doing, right? Is my blog post a scholarly publication? This open access journal, we can spoof it, right? How do I know what's credible and what's not credible and how do we accept it, et cetera? That we're at the passing of the baby boom echo, right? The baby boom comes, colleges get bigger. The baby boomers graduate, they get a little bit smaller. Baby boomers have kids, we get even bigger. That's going away. We don't have another baby boom echo, and so we see drops in enrollments, complete competition for enrollments, et cetera. The rise of for-profits, academic debt. Today, the average U.S. citizen has more debt to pay tuition than they do to pay their credit cards. That's a problem. Debating the value of a liberal education. Do we still need liberal arts? Do humanities still matter? What's very interesting, for example, a major university was creating a China branch. And the discussion became, okay, you're in China and you have a political science program. What can you talk about? What can't you talk about, et cetera? And the president got up and said, we are committed to a liberal education. And what he meant by that is that we're going to have a political science program. The political scientist said, but what about the content of what it's going to teach? And then it was like, well, and suddenly this whole debate came about, is that what a university's for, academic freedom, et cetera. MOOCs, flipped classrooms, and disruptions. And that's what I want to talk about as where I think they can learn a lot from us. Right? So what we've got going on right now, and I'll just pick on this thing called the flipped classroom. And the flipped classroom, my basic definition is swapping lectures for homework and homework for collaboration. Right? So classrooms used to look exactly like this and function exactly like this. I would sit up here, you would listen, I would talk, you would be confused and leave, and that would be okay with me. And you would go home, and by yourself, you would sit and read, and then come back, and I would talk at you again. That works for certain things, but it doesn't work for a lot of things, right? This idea that, back to that idea where he talked about the doctor being the person who looks at you as a bunch of problems, and they give you a prescription and leave. This is the old thing about the bucket model of education, that you guys are all buckets, and I'm throwing out bricks of knowledge, and hopefully your bucket is big enough that it can handle the brick, because if it's not, then you're stupid, and we don't care, and you fail. This is not how we think about education these days. This is linked to a need for innovation within the MOOCs. We have these MOOCs, massive open online courses now with 30,000 people, and people all over the world are taking them. And really, the problem is that most of these MOOCs look like a lecture hall with 30,000 students. Because think about what's happening right here and right now and how ineffective I'm being. Right? You could be amongst 30,000 people. Would it matter? Because I'm still sitting. Oh, it might be hard to see me, but we'll get a big screen. Right? In this give and take, or lack therein, it doesn't matter the number here. And that's what MOOCs look like. Right? Or MOOCs look like annotated textbooks. Read through it, and I'll give you a little lecture on part of it. I did a MOOC this summer. That's what it looked like. If any of you had to survive it, you can pretty much say, that's what it looked like. Right? But flipping is not just lecturing to people in their pajamas. The idea isn't, well, great, now I can just stream out my videos and do change nothing, but they can watch it late at night. What flipping should be is, yes, what matters? What matters is presence. If you guys took the time to drive through the horrible snow, if you guys took the time to come here from wherever, can't we do something a little bit more constructive than me sitting there talking to you? Because the truth is, we could Skype and I could do this at when you're in your pajamas. Let's not do that, Bill. Right. But the idea being that, right, it doesn't matter. So what they say is, what happens if we came together and what could we do more interesting? Could we build something? Could we try something? Could we talk about something? Could we argue with something? Could we have conversations with something? So I have some victims of my class, of a flipped classroom right here. So when I leave, they'll tell you the truth about whether it works. But I have to say, what I did is I said, all right, here's the textbook. You can read it on your own. Here's some lectures. Put them in groups and said, your job for each class is to organize a conversation around it. And they did a much more brilliant job of doing it than I could. Right? So any guys on the marshmallow one? I love the marshmallow one. Oh, that was a great one. Tell us the marshmallow one. What was the exercise? Uncooked spaghetti, by the way. It's important.
It's great, thank you. And they had scissors, and they had to automate and try to build a structure so that the marshmallow was the highest part of the structure.
Right.
And we used it as a metaphor to represent how that the structure we built might not accommodate. We might have a picture of the marshmallow. So sorry,
Mr. Ruby. Oh, yeah, it's fine. Better job than I could. Right. So the job, you had the spaghetti, you had these like spaghetti twine and a marshmallow, and the idea was get the marshmallows high off. There were six groups, and one group got it a half inch off, and everyone else was sitting there on the ground. And the idea was, that why? Because they paid attention to the structure of the spaghetti, and everyone built these elaborate little structures, and they looked beautiful, and they looked like, you know, massive towers, and then they put the marshmallow on, and inevitably they would all go, boom. And the argument was that your community is the marshmallow where you should be spending attention. And in fact, we spend attention to the structure and infrastructure. So when we plan a community service, when we plan a great service, we spend all the time on a committee and our rules and policies. And then finally, at the end, we go, anyone care? Right? Well, maybe we should start the other way around. Anyway, that was more interesting than I could have come up with. And then one group that brought in a speaker, and one group, I mean, it was fascinating. And the point is, that's more interactive than what I could do by sitting here and doing this one. So higher ed needs to look a lot more like libraries, inquiry driven, not based on what we think you should know, but what do you want to know, right? The idea of saying, if I want to teach you, Mike Eisenberg gave me this example, he had a doctoral student said, I want to study the information systems of Christian education. And Eisenberg said, great, go study the education systems for Muslim education. And the doctoral student said, no, I want to do Christian education. And Mike said, do Muslims. He goes, no, I want to do Christian. He goes, if you're studying information and infrastructure, the Christian and Muslim part shouldn't matter. So where do we focus? So the idea is inquiry driven, they may want to look at Christian whatever, but we're going to make sure that they learn information literacy, mathematics, whatever, out of that thing. That it's a hybrid and physical digital environment. We use presence where it matters. So about a third of our library science students are online distance folks. They show up to campus once, they never have to come back. But when they're on campus, we make sure they're in groups, they're talking to each other, they're meeting people, they're getting all this other stuff that they can't get when they leave. So we take the advantage of presence, and then we ship them off because a lot of the stuff we could do online. We do that in our libraries. There's a lot of stuff that we provide to people through computers and interfaces, but then there's stuff that we only do in person, from story time to workshops to databases that are license restricted to locations to special collections to archiving, etc. So we've sort of had to deal and think about, as librarians, how does this work? And now you see higher education doing it, right? So Harvard announced that they're not just going to do MOOCs, they're going to do, and I'm going to get this wrong, but it's like SMOOCs. It's small, open, online courses with like 12 people and an instructor, and you sit there and go, you mean like distance education that we've been doing for 30 years? Good, Harvard, you've discovered it for us. It's now legitimate. But, right? It occurs in a resource-rich environment, and resources have multiple sources. Right? Imagine if your library had one author, and yet when we give them a big topics like librarianship, they have one instructor who assigns his own textbook. You're welcome again, right? And that learning is a collaboration between an expert and a novice. That what we have to make sure that we don't teach higher education, that we don't lead higher education, is that higher education, we don't look at libraries as a model because they're collection focused. We should be community focused. That we don't look at libraries and say, oh, we need to be functionally oriented. We need to be mission oriented. That we don't say, we're information-based libraries. We provide lots of stuff. This is like, I hate this phrase. Librarians are the best search engines. No, you're not. You suck at being a search engine. Can you provide 30,000 results in 10 milliseconds? No, you cannot. And half of it geared for advertising, and then, you know, porn sort of filtered out of it. Is this really what competition you want to have? Right? We use search engines. We should. So the idea isn't online education is here are 50,000 articles. Good luck. Right? It needs to instead be based on progressive libraries that see learning and participation in the community as core. We don't want to replace the stodgy old professor afraid of change with a risk-averse librarian focused on artifacts and authority. When we talk about higher education needs to look more like libraries, what we mean is they need to be more inquiry-driven, they need to be more community-driven, they need to be this hybrid environment. Now, what does higher education look like in that world? Well, right now what we do is we take people and we start them out, right? So they start out with their bachelor's. You want to be an engineer, you want to be a mathematician, get your bachelor's. You work for 5-10 years, that becomes useless, so come back and get your master's degree, then you'll know how to manage. And then you work for 10 more years and you want to be really useless, so you come back and you get a doctorate, and we prepare you to be whatever people are with doctorates. And the idea is that we sort of like recharge people. We begin them at the career. And so the idea, for example, our library science students are going to take a management course, and they're going to talk about budgeting, and they're going to talk about personnel, and they're going to talk about policy. And they may never touch those topics until 10, 15 years when they're a library director, and they desperately need them. And then they're going to look for their notes, right? So this idea that we sort of, right now, higher education has a commencement model. We begin people's careers. We're there at the beginning, we sanction them, and we throw them into the wolves. We're moving to a continuing education model. So in if you're a teacher, you have to go back and get certain continuing education, get recertified, et cetera. But we need to move to a continuous education model. What does that mean? Well, that means we might start with the 18-year-old trying to learn about being an engineer or a mathematician, and we want to take them until they retire. But instead of thinking about every so often giving them a degree where we charge them large amounts of money, sending them off with their degree, and then asking as alumni for them to send us more money, we build an ongoing relationship that interweaves their work life and their education. So rather than thinking about periodic, they're on a regular basis re-engaging back with the profession. They, as an alumni, you don't get sort of, now we can ask you for money. It's like a subscription-based model. That you come in, and if you want another course or a refresher or more certification or all this, you don't go for another degree. You just pop in and hop in and hop out. A continuous engagement between learning and work and life. And we need to focus on accreditation over the monopoly of delivery. This is back to that single source, right? A library with one author. Right now, when you go to get a degree, we've joined the you know what you're talking about with the teaching you what you're talking about. And it may sound really weird to say, how do you separate that out? How do you separate out giving someone a master's in library science from teaching them library science? But this happens all the time. This is one model of innovation, where innovation, you take a technology company like IBM. And IBM used to define computing in the 70s as the hardware, the services, the software, everything. When you bought a computer, you got everything. And then they came out with these little personal computers, and they asked this fellow by the name of Bill Gates and Paul Allen, could you develop the operating system? And Microsoft said, by the way, can we own the operating system when we're done? And IBM said, sure. It's useless. You can't do it without the technology, the service, the sales force, the consulting, the hardware. You can't do that, but sure, you can own it. So they don't care. But what Microsoft sort of saw was, you know what? It's pretty soon. Computing is not going to be defined as everything. It's going to be defined as hardware is one sector, software is another sector, operating system another sector. And so by taking a monolithic view of a field like computing, breaking it into pieces and innovating the piece, they were able to gain market advantage. Same thing happened when Netscape developed the browser. Now, I know this is ancient history, but some of you may remember. At the time, Microsoft said, the internet's useless. It might be nice to share a document or something, but really, no one's going to use the internet. The idea of a browser being useful, give me a break. So Netscape come and said, and they built the Internet Explorer, which to this day still sucks. And Netscape went out and said, no, and they got an IPO and they got massive amounts of money. Then a little company called Google comes around and says, you know what? It's not so much how you're surfing, it's where you're surfing and how you find it. Netscape once again says, can't do it without a browser. We're vital. Google then sits there and says, search is where it is, and we keep replacing. Now imagine doing that with higher education, right? So if you're in the medical world, you're used to some sort of medical health record. But imagine instead of a medical health record that tracks when you got sick and what you got in treatment, we talk about a personal education record. That is, as you progress through life, you're building a portfolio. And that rather than that portfolio simply being something that belongs to you, in other words, you went to SU, SU created your transcript, think instead that after you get that degree and you're out in the world, you take an online MOOC, right? Now what happens is we didn't necessarily offer the MOOC, but then you can come back to SU, come back to your institution and say, I now know this because I took this course elsewhere, certify that I know it, and SU begins to own that record, and so it's now in your record says they know what they got here. So we're accrediting their knowledge, we're not necessarily delivering the whole thing. We're splitting those two pieces. Now, there's another analogy with medical health records. You own your health records, but you don't get to edit them. You don't have guardianship of them, right? The hospital, the doctor guards, updates, maintains your record, but you own them. So you can get a copy anytime you want. So the idea of you don't necessarily, when you put your resume together, let's face it, half the people looking at the resume are going, where's the lie? Where's the lie, right? They don't necessarily trust it, but if it comes from a trusted source, and particularly if it's a very, you know, you've got Harvard certifying it, then it matters. So you get Microsoft certification, you get degrees from Hamilton College, you go where, you take all these courses, and you constantly have this relationship back to this institution that's certifying you know it. And what becomes even more interesting is that not only do we have this, but who's doing the certifying? Well, the faculty can do certifying, right? We know, we can say, you know, this economics, you know, whatever. But we also have all of these members now, our alumni, that also have this expertise, and so maybe I don't know about that MOOC, but you do. And you work across the globe, but you're willing, maybe for a little kickback or reduction of taking additional courses, to go in and say, yes, that's certified, I agree with that. And then what's nice is all of the people begin to do the pool. So we begin to talk about higher education not as this monolithic, we house you, we give you access to fraternities, we feed you, we give you sports events, oh, by the way, we teach you every so often, and we give you the degree, to this idea of you're going out and learning all the time, and we're certifying that what you know. So an employer can come back to us and say, do they really know this? Yes. It's a radically different relationship that we have then between those who take the course and those who deliver the course, because that barrier begins to disappear. We have this in our library students right now. They come in and they say, I want to know more about Pinterest. Now, as a faculty member with tenure, I sit there and go, Pinterest is merely an example of, and go into some bogus theory that's useless, right? That's what I do. And they sit there and go, I still want to know about Pinterest. And so what they've begun doing is organizing their own lectures, their own discussion groups. They put together this, Lisa, and who teaches those? Right. And you know, last year they wanted to know about integrated library systems, and SUNY was going through a new one, so they brought in Steve Whitener, who's the director of SUNY ESF, and he walked through it. But the point of that is, that's valuable learning. Why can't we give them credit for that valuable learning? Well, they're not professors. Who cares? They know what they're talking about. And we can certify that and create this ongoing relationship. So my point of all of this is, when you look at librarianship, we spend so much time worrying about serving these people, and we should. But we also have to talk about, maybe these people need some major transformation like we did, do, are in the midst of. We could teach them. A Stagio professor going, I can't flip the classroom because if the students have input, then they're going to lower the standards of the class. Tell me you've never encountered that situation. You mean I'm going to let students grade their own papers? What are you, ridiculous? Yeah. We have to say, you know, you can still be an expert and a big head and it's okay, but you can let students do some of the driving as well. If you don't, you know, the pivot table on Pinterest, let them teach that, and then you can say, by the way, that's a larger example of, and that's going to make them more interested, more knowledgeable, more part of the system, and there you get to still be an expert. It's okay. Which brings us to the next one. So I said, pretend this is your personal education record. Let's transform it back to a health record. So a health record is interesting because we've always looked at this idea that, you know, you have a doctor and the doctor says, this is the record, I'm going to add to it. So, right, the idea, so I'm in the midst of treatment for cancer, which is delightful, and I've encountered so many different kinds of doctors now. Right? So I no longer talk about doctors. I've got family practitioners. I've got oncologists. I've got hematologists. I've got surgeons. I've got anesthesiologists. I've got all these people. And my favorite has been surgeons. Right? Because surgeons want to talk with you when you're anesthetized and ready to be cut open. Right? That's when they want to have their conversation. Right? Because, you know, I called the doctor up. Right? I had a biopsy. He's like, all right, well, we're going to try and go down here and get this lymph node. He goes, but if we can't get that, we're going to flip you on your side, flip your arm over, go through your ribs, deflate your lung, grab the lymph node and pull it out. Okay, let's go. And I'm like, back up two steps. Deflate what? Don't I need those? Oh, we do it all the time. We blow it back up. It's great. And then you might wake up with a chest tube. A chest tube. Right? To him, it's like, it's a tube coming out of your chest. It's disturbing. Right? So you sort of want to say, can we talk about this a little bit? Right? This idea of when you go into the doctor and you say, by the way, what about this treatment? What about that treatment? I had a doctor. I love this doctor. But at the same time, I said, I was being treated. I said, you know, I found this great book about this condition. He goes, oh, don't bring me a book. I said, no, but it really could help. He goes, don't bring me the book. I said, why? He goes, he walks over and he pulls out a drawer full of books. He goes, these are all the books my patients bring me. You know how many I've read? Boom, closes the drawer. Proudly closes the drawer. And you sit there and go, really? Right? How is this conversation going to occur? How can we have this discussion? Like I say, research shows us that the more I as a patient am engaged and knowledgeable about my condition, the better the outcomes. And that's different than take this pill, take that pill, we're going to cut you open. So imagine now that this medical health record isn't just the doctor telling us what we think, but we can begin to contribute. Let's start with something really stupidly simple, right? So I'm walking around with this sitting on my pocket. It's a Fitbit. And the Fitbit says that I walked 873 steps, so I need to walk more while I'm giving this lecture, right? By the way, if you ever want to get the number up, mow the lawn on a riding mower. 3,000 steps. What were you doing? I have not stooped to putting it on my dog yet, but it's coming. So now when the doctor sits there and says, so Dave, have you been exercising? Instead of me just doing what I naturally do, which is lie through my teeth, yes, I've been exercising, he can say, well, that's interesting. Your hip doesn't seem to think so, right? We can begin to add this data. We have data that gives not only how many walked and flights of stairs, we can know pulse oximeters, we can know heartbeat, we can know all of this stuff. And they can directly feed this data back in. And you sit there and go, all right, Dave, but that's not exactly a conversation. That's just sort of like the NSA of medicine. They're just sort of spying on what you're doing. But what about if we begin to include things like medical prescription or information prescriptions? We're talking about in hospitals now, not simply saying, all right, you're checking you out. You've got to do this. You're going to see the doctor in 2 weeks. Take these pills. But also read these articles, understand this information, go to this website, et cetera. They're giving prescriptions for information. When you're, and I hope you never have this, but when you're diagnosed with cancer, the American Cancer Society is the enemy of every tree on the planet because you suddenly get shipped like books on what you're going through and all this other stuff to the point where it's back to here's a lot of information, good luck. But at least they understand that this information is vital part of what you're doing. And so now we can also include things like how are you feeling? I cannot tell you, once again, through cancer treatment, how many times I've been asked, are you depressed? Yes. You know, it's like they, you know, hi, Dave, you have cancer. How do you feel about that? Pretty good. I was, you know, I was telling my wife this. I'm like, you know, now the universe revolves around me. It's all about me again. I'm okay with that, right? But why not look at what they're talking about, what they're encountering, journaling. Once again, we know the idea that people express ideas and we can get this data online. We can use it as an ongoing conversation for what's happening. We can lead to better outcomes. And when you combine all this, you begin to look at the idea of instead of this mass medicine, an individualized medicine. So this, for example, is a medical device, implanted device. It's not a pacemaker. It actually delivers drugs. There are drugs that are within it. So what can happen is you're going running, and on a real-time basis, this telemetry is going into the medical health record, and suddenly it sees this interesting AFib. And the doctor or nurse gets alerted to the fact that you have a heart patient and you're having this irregular rhythm, and they can, in real time, deliver medication to counter the situation. No longer going home and calling up and going, I think maybe Tuesday kind of hurt, whatever. They can actually look at the data. And they can go and see what you said and how you're doing. They want to know if you're depressed. Read what you're writing. And so this suddenly becomes a conversation. Now, what I'm bringing up about this is, if you look at this in a really interesting way, this is librarianship. I mean, yes, a doctor must be a doctor. Seth MacFarlane had a great joke. He goes, remember that laughter is the best medicine after medicine, right? You still want a doctor. You still want a professor who's knowledgeable in the area. You still want a lawyer when you're going to law school. But we no longer sit back and take it at face value. We no longer have a society that says, you are my authority, I go without question. And we know that if we, by adopting this self-service, by adopting this idea of being proactive and understanding your treatment, your case, your life, whatever, you're better. You have better outcomes. You're healthier. You're happier. Right? So this isn't just a nice thing about, oh, the entitled class has access to Google, so we should listen to them. This is by them having access to information, particularly high-quality information that comes from our libraries and special libraries, and understanding that, they get healthier, they get happier, they get wealthier, they get better. So what we have is, yes, we should serve these folks. We should be good medical librarians. We should be good legal librarians. We should be good librarians and provide excellent service. But we should also be role models. We should be exemplars. We should be change agents, not simply answering a question, but stopping and saying, by the way, how's that medical practice going? Have you thought about it? Right? One of the complaints I hear from doctors over and over again is they come in with all this heuristic crap. They come in and they think that if they just burn sage leaves on Thursday, that lymphoma disappears. Well, the answer isn't to sit there and go, they're stupid, or write them another prescription for what they should get. The answer is to say, all right, if that's where they are now, how do we move them to a place where they are more effective in terms of outcomes, right? Which is a learning process, which is teaching, which is participatory and interactive. It's the same thing that we do. Oh, those undergraduates are stupid. How many articles do I have to read about undergraduates being stupid before I say, wait a minute, they're not that stupid, right? They're actually pretty smart. So Allison Head does this great stuff on information literacy. And she looked at undergraduates and said, undergraduates, when you do your assignments, what do you do? And they say, we all start with Wikipedia, but we never cite it. Why? Because we know that the professors will criticize us and mark us down if we cite Wikipedia. But it's a brilliant place to start to find all the articles that we eventually do it. Okay? That's smart. That's not lazy. That's understanding the system of rewards in front of them. And so if we as librarians understand that, why don't we start with, let's go to Wikipedia. Now, this is the advantages and disadvantages of it, as opposed to standing up and railing against using low-quality resources. Right? We have to talk about progressing people in a learning process. To be a librarian is to be in the learning business. And increasingly, to be a doctor is to be in a learning business. And to be a professor is always supposed to have been being in the learning business. But we understand so much more about learning now. We understand it's not simply those of the top 5% that, frankly, you could sit here and speak in gibberish and they would still understand. It's the 100%. Some of them learn quickly. Some of them learn visually. Some of them learn through writing. This is what we need to be demonstrating. Right now, doctors are terrified of letting the patient into the process. They're terrified for two reasons. One, that we'll screw it up, which is a beneficial look. In other words, they are worried about us. They're so worried about us, they don't even want to let us to be part of the process, which is remarkably how librarians approach privacy. Privacy is so important, we're not going to give you a choice. Right? What did I read last Thursday? I can't tell you because the Patriot Act, they might show up and ask. Get rid of it. As opposed to teaching people about privacy, teaching them about it. They're also terrified that if we let them in, if we let the patients become part of the process, we will somehow be less. Our expertise will be less valued. We will have less status. We will be seen as less important. And librarians have had this personality problem for a long time. Now that Google's out there, do they need us anymore? Right? Now that people can search online and they don't have to come through us for Boolean search queries, do they want us? Now that all this digitized stuff and Amazon's there, do they need our collections? We've had this crisis of confidence. And we're coming out of that by realizing that our role is not search engines. Our role is not pack rats and collectors. It's guides, facilitation, conversation, expertise, and integration of information. Doctors need to learn that. Professors need to learn that. Lawyers need to learn that. We have a pressure from a community for participation. People want to be part of their lives and important decisions. And we've given for so long, we've abdicated that to experts. Now that we want some of it back, the experts are worried. We're worried. But we have to learn better outcomes come from this. Better productivity comes from this. So in conclusions, we must teach as well as serve. Don't just go to a doctor, go to a lawyer, go to a professor, go to a museum expert, go to your members, your service population and say, here's what you need. Don't sit there in a university and talk about scholarly communication is in crisis. We're going to wait for the faculty to figure it out and then we'll step in. Don't trust people like us with scholarly communication. We screwed it up in the first place. We need people who can walk in and talk about this is important, how we understand it, provenance is important, we have confidence, we have documents. We need to teach people about participation and the role of expertise. We don't need to turn them into librarians, but we need to teach them how we became good librarians. The point isn't to make everyone into a librarian. The point is to take them really great doctors, they take the best of what we've learned about participation in forming people into the process and incorporate it into there. These fields need our innovation more than they need our collections. And this can be hard for people to think. I see it all the time. Librarians go in to meetings of the American Medical Association or whatever it is, and they sit there and they say, can we provide a collection for this? Oh, we can do a lib guide for you on this. Oh, we can do this. And what they're saying is, our value here is that we can find and collect stuff. Instead of, we need to radically think how your practice goes. We need to think about patient-centered management. What does that mean? These fields need our innovation more than they need our collections. So I come back to our opening slide. We need to save libraries by saving the world. By going out and talking about libraries are in trouble, we need, libraries are closing, we're getting rid of librarians, oh, woe is me, libraries are too important, and quoting Neil Gaiman as often as we can. To be important, you don't become important by walking around saying, I'm important, I'm important, I'm important. You do it by being important, by being vital, by being part of it. So I use these two examples often. This is Kenya. And in Kenya, they're building as many public libraries as they can. They're building them in every city they can. Where they can't get to build libraries, they actually have donkey carts that take collections and librarians out to remote villages. In the north, where even the donkeys can't go, they're building libraries that go on the backs of camels. And they lay it out, and they work with parents and teachers and reading and literacy. The village gets excited when they come in. Camel is their most important asset in these villages. It provides labor. It provides transportation. When they die, they provide food. They use their dung to power their stoves. And now they're seen as vital because they provide learning and knowledge. This is the Library of Alexandria during the last Egyptian revolution, when as people went to destroy government buildings, to bring down the administration of Mubarak, and they turned and they were going to take out the Library of Alexandria that Mubarak built, that his wife was on the board from, all the protesters began joining hand in hand to surround the building to prevent any damage to it. And the question was why? The answer to why wasn't because librarians had done a really good marketing job about how important librarians were. Right? This, when we do camels and we bring people in and we get mothers sitting with children learning to read and materials, we don't do it because we walked around and said how important librarians are and how we need to save libraries. The reason that people are willing to risk life and limb to defend buildings, to send animals out to the farthest reaches, to defend and do these things is because librarians have made a positive impact in their life. They've changed their lives for the better. I'm talking to librarians after the Egyptian uprising, after the Arab Spring, grandmothers and taxi drivers started coming into the library. They said, we heard about this Facebook thing. We heard about social media. Can you show me that? That didn't happen because of a great marketing campaign about come to the library and learn Facebook. It became because the library was their most crucial place. It was the best bandwidth connection in all of Alexandria, and they were seen as useful and vital. We save libraries not by marketing ourselves. We save libraries by using marketing, using collections, using services, using our time, using our spaces to improve people's lives. So when we assess how well we do it, a gate count isn't a good assessment. A circulation count isn't a good assessment. Success of our patrons, of our members, of our customers, that's where we need to look. So we need to save libraries, but we do it by doing a damn good job. And we're going to save medicine, and we're going to save law, and we're going to save higher education, and we're going to save all these professional service industries. And if you sit there and smirk and go, yeah, like doctors will listen to us, why not? Are you so much less valuable to the world? Because if you are, you're not doing it right. If you see yourselves as unworthy, if you see yourselves as not being as powerful as those that we serve, as beneficial to the world, as crucial to the welfare of your community as those that you serve, then you're not doing it right. Librarianship is about improving the world, not documenting it, not collecting it, not taking pictures of it. Librarianship is about making people healthier, wealthier, wiser. It's about redefining the American dream, not by becoming rich and becoming part of the 1%, but by becoming satisfied and achieving your aspirations. And we do that teacher by teacher, doctor by doctor, mother by mother, child by child. We do these connections all the time, but it's vital and important that we do it. The work we do is essential. We sit in the middle, the nexus of the knowledge age, and it's our obligation not simply to serve the world, but help improve it and help save it. That's what we mean by improved society, and that's ultimately our mission. Fair enough? All right, I went short. We have time for questions, comments, and everything I got wrong, and I'm going to pour myself some water. So, hello. So, how's it? These guys heard this already, so sorry about that. Yes?
I don't have a question, but your reiteration of the save libraries by saving the world had me thinking for a second and putting something down, which is, in my mind, another way to say that is the library is not about the us that is me and fellow library professionals, but it's about the us that is them / all of us. So me as a community member, you're going back to your of member versus user or patron.
Right. There's you're gonna have a great conference. I've seen the thing. You're gonna have a great. How many people, your members, your users, pick the term that you like, your patrons. How many of them are here today as well? When you talk about interfaces and how to improve interfaces, when you talk about how to improve services, how much of that is us talking to ourselves, and how much of that is us talking with the people we're working with and making them part of the decision-making process? The other thing is, I'm a big fan of the selfish gene. That is, we do good in order to do well. In other words, the more we improve the functioning of our universities, the better we make our doctors, the better that we work with our lawyers, the better circumstances we create for ourselves. The public librarians. If you're working in an area that has a large amount of homelessness, by helping affect the homelessness problem, you improve your own status. You improve your own world. You improve your own living conditions. By looking at yourself as not separate from the community, but as part of the community, by improving the community, you improve your own lot. Right? That's back to this, our success needs to be determined not by our budget and our collection strength, but by the successes of those that we serve. Right? Comes back to it helps us and it benefits us. So yeah, the we isn't just librarians talking amongst them, working amongst themselves. It is mobilizing their communities to action as well. Other questions or comments? Yes? Right. Johns Hopkins did a study around a new drug, and the first patient, I forget the name of the drug, I could look it up, but the first patient did great with it, the second patient had a little breathing problems, and the third one died of pneumonia. And they looked at it and said, why did this happen? And they went back and they found out that there were actually experiments with these drugs in the 60s that showed significant respiratory issues with this drug. Why didn't they find them? Because they used the online Medline database at the time that only went back to like 1980. And what Johns Hopkins did out of that was they then made part of every clinical trial a consultation with the library, where the librarian had to go through and do the literature review in addition to what they did. That's that sort of extrinsic motivation. The other thing that we have to be careful about, and I think this is where we can teach back and forth, is that, so I've been in a situation where the doctor, my wife, I love my wife, but she asked the question that I don't have the guts to ask, which is, so what is the potential outcome of this treatment? In other words, is my husband, what's the odds that my husband's going to die after this? And the doctors were really good. He said, oh, this is great, 50%. That's where I am right now, don't worry about it. But the worst part is, it's 50% because it was after, so Hodgkin's lymphoma has a 90% survival rate with first issue chemotherapy. I didn't pass that 90, so I'm down to 10. So when he talks about 50%, he's really talking about 5% from initial diagnosis, right? I have all those stats. What I need is a doctor to say, but I've seen this case before, and I'm going to, right? So the evidence base is great because it gives them all that wonderful data. But what we know as librarians is we know that the human touch is equally important, right? So doctors can't simply sit back with the data and say, good luck. It matters that they're, we know that, for example, librarians, if they want to increase satisfaction with reference, I'm going to pick on Bill, with in-person reference, this is what they need to do. After they get the answer, go, did that help? Satisfaction goes up dramatically. Just by asking the question and physical contact, we're appropriate, right? We're inappropriate, it either goes way up or way down. But, right? That human touch, and it's back to that, look, evidence-based doesn't mean that your expertise and experience doesn't matter, it enriches it. Just like as librarians, when people come in having already started the search and done the easy stuff, it's not that they value us less, it's that now we get to really show our stuff, right? The most insulting question you can ask on virtual reference, have you searched Google? It's like, yeah, I wouldn't be here if I hadn't, right? That idea of how are you allowed to be an expert and listen at the same time, that's something that, one, we need to learn, and two, that's what we need to teach. Other comments or questions? Yes?
When you're talking about higher education, what you're really talking about is lifelong learning.
Yes. Yeah. Christine, so I'm always convinced that there's a lot we can learn from K-12 education and higher education, the testing and Common Core, not so much, but the idea of authentic assessment, of including students in on you know, hands-on building portfolios, that's exactly what we're talking about, which is, you know, I love them and we're taking their money. You guys are going to be librarians after 2.5 years. Congratulations. But I think you're only going to be really good librarians if every day of every work day you're constantly learning something new or investigating. And right now we expect it. In some fields, we certify it. But as higher education institutions, how do we facilitate it, right? I think we have an obligation. I have an obligation to you folks. When you graduate, you come back in 2 years and go, right? I should be there to say, oh, try this. Have you talked to this? Have you heard this kind of stuff? And if I don't know, I should have a network to say, you got to talk to Bill, right? That creating a lifelong learning network as well, where your expertise and what you learned, because I want you to come back and speak to the first year students in 5 years about your success. Yeah.
External training. Did I catch it right that you had some suggestions on how that would actually work in terms of how we'll be funding? Because that would be my greatest concern, is that it's a fantastic idea, and I personally love it because I've lived around so much in the past.
Right. Right. I think this is right. So this is part of the MOOC problem, is that people look, particularly technologists, look at the higher ed and they do this, right? Ooh, and the lesson they should first take away is what happened to private universities, private for profit. I should be clear, like Phoenix. Phoenix looked at higher education and went, ooh, money. And what they did was they built the exact same funding model that the not-for-profits and publics did, which is government funding. What they looked at was a lot of government loan and debt, GI Bill, the idea of putting you guys in debt. And the problem is that meant, since they built it on the same structure, as we looked at economic declines, as we looked at new purposes, they were just as hurt, just as disadvantaged as everyone else. Now people in the MOOC, MOOCs are saying, Google saying, we can just do the education part, and we just do 30,000 people, and that'll be great. But they haven't figured out the business model, right? And to them, it's okay because they're an ad agency making plenty of money, right? So one, I think we need to look at things like subscription prices. In other words, rather than tuition, look at lifelong learning, a subscription. And a subscription, actually, this is where libraries can be really useful. When we look at copy cataloging in a library loan, these are actual business models that are kind of interesting. So imagine, you know, you come in, you took my course, you paid tuition, et cetera. 5 years later, you're teaching a course, we're paying you back, or we're decreasing that tuition, or whatever. So in other words, it's kind of like open access journals, right? You can do the green or the gold. You can do paying for peer review, or you can provide the peer review, and you can bring. These are interesting library-based business models that are institutionalized and relatively successful over long periods of time that we can apply back to higher education, because higher education right now is the credit hour. Does anyone know where the credit hour came from? No. Initially, it came as a labor negotiation. It came as a way of figuring out how much to pay me as a professor, right? And yes, it was roughly based on contact hour, but it was never, it was based on labor and effort. It was never based on learning and outcomes, right? So now in the universities, we talk about 3 credit courses. And in us, that's a shorthand for how much content it is, right? But it was never intended to be that way. And the truth is that if you come into my class and you want to know about topic X and you already know half of it, and you come into my class and you know none of it, those should really be different credit hours and different ways of participating, but because we sort of built this institutional structure. When we offered the MOOC and we wanted to give an option for graduate credit, they say, oh, then you have to offer it from this date to this date because that's a Maymester. And we're like, but we want to offer it from July to this. And they're like, we can't do that. Why? Because we don't know how to pay people over 2 Maymesters at 0.5 CEUs and stuff. And we're like, this is stupid. Right? This is really stupid. So I think there are business models that we can teach as well as the actual facilitation process. You're welcome. Yes? Huge. I think that's brilliant. I think, one, I'm a big fan of going to conversations, not trying to create them, right? So this is like my line about, you know, adding social networking features to a catalog is like staple gunning a satellite dish to a donkey. You can do it, but why? Right? You know, it's like, did you really turn the donkey into a media center? You know, but so, great. So how many people are going to come to your catalog so they can chat with their friends when their friends are on Facebook or LinkedIn or Pinterest or Twitter or what have you? We need to go out and use those networks. The question is, imagine if you were Harvard or Syracuse or whatever, going to LinkedIn and say, next time you get that endorsement, would you like that endorsement to come with our endorsement? Because we already have a national reputation. We're already accredited by this. We already buy into it. Universities have bought into the fact that we accredit. Right? So if we could do that and form those relationships and in an intellectually honest way, not just with LinkedIn, but also with Facebook and what have you, that I think would be really powerful. And that's the idea of separating out the delivery of instruction, which some of us are good at and some of us aren't, from the accrediting of knowledge, which some of us are good at and some aren't. But, you know, that's a value that universities have. Right? We used to think the value was socialization. And we still do, right? Freshmen come, they're 18, they're stupid. Right? Or as my sister once said, they lack vitamin brain. I thought that was interesting. I know it's a derogatory view, but stick with me for a minute, right? So what do? We put them, all these people, these raging hormonal people, into dormitories and say, you're not at home anymore, you have no parental supervision, go, right? We don't hopefully do that anymore. But what we said is, it used to be crucial that you were in dorms, and we've had policy for dorms, and we built dorms, ESF just built dorms, OCC built dorms around this idea. Syracuse now outsourced their latest dorm, Irving Davis, they don't own it. They lease the land to it, and it's privately run. So we've already begun sort of breaking out that, what is a university? Well, it's not housing anymore. It's not food anymore. And let's face it, athletics are really interesting, but they're almost a private industry on their own. So we keep breaking ourselves apart. And so the idea of breaking apart the delivery instruction from the accrediting of knowledge isn't a massive step. My former colleague and brilliant mentor, Jeff Katzer, once said, you pay me not to teach, you pay me to grade. And so, you know, we can, that idea of the endorsement. And I think we also have models. SUNY, Empire State College, yeah, where you come in and you say, I've been a project manager, et cetera. How many credits do I get for that? They say, this many, and you need this additional, right? How do we give life credit? How do we give the idea you already have experience? And that's going to go from this monolithic view to a much more nuanced view and a much more entrepreneurial view and a much more library view, because once again, how do we start a reference interview? What do you know already? Let's build on top of that, as opposed to, okay, this is Google and you click here, right? We don't do that because we sort of start with the discussion about what you already know. Does that make sense? So yes, I think building on social networks as opposed to building our own social networks, vital and important. That's all right. It's your day. Yeah, I'll stick around for a while.